Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Politics Uncensored. I am Ali Milani here at FUBAR Radio, and we have a big, big show for you today. Lots to talk about. Things are moving. We are definitely in an election year, and that means that we have lots of movement in terms of policy and political announcements. The first big news of the week is not so much in the Westminster political bubble, but a royal story that broke. And that is that King Charles has been diagnosed with cancer, and you're going to be hearing probably a lot around the royal family and the treatment that he is receiving. So no doubt everybody will be wishing him the best of health in his treatment. But we've got lots of other stories to talk about today. Primarily, we're going to be focusing the show on a new poll by the Labour Muslim Network that has found that 43% of Labour voters intend on staying with the party since 2019, with 23% of them being undecided. Starmer's favourabilities were at minus 11%, and it has been called a crisis point by Muslims across the party. We're going to be talking to Sunder Katwala, Director of British Future, and Murad Qureshi, former member of the London Assembly. They're going to be joining me later on in the show to discuss this topic. But before we get to that, we are doing the Week Unwrapped, and that is where we discuss and react to the biggest political stories of the week. And joining me in the studio, we have Deputy Leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski. Zach, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping, Zach?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
Keeping well. Thank you so much for joining us. And before, listen, it's very easy for my first questions for you today, as you will have seen and no doubt I'll be reacting to, and that is that Labour is set to announce the end of a £28 billion Green pledge of investment. This was a sort of frontier main announcement made in 2021 by, say, Keir Starmer and the leadership that kind of pointed to the party's future in terms of green investment and jobs and economic growth. The party is expected to roll back on that and say as it's a result of economic changes. It comes after a plethora of U-turns and policies that have seen the bin. What's your reaction to essentially the pulling of the plug of this policy?
My reaction is, what is Labour thinking? This should be the most basic measure to be able to promote. This is ultimately investment both in our planet and in our society. If you take retrofitting, for instance, upgrading people's homes, that's a triple win. Reduces bills, reduces emissions, and creates good green jobs. Now, Labour's argument has always been there's no money left or our fiscal rules, but they refuse to tax the wealthy. They talk about a cost of living crisis, but this is actually an inequality crisis. There are multimillionaires and billionaires who are doing perfectly well, and Labour refuse to talk about taxing them while saying they won't protect the planet. This is shameful, and they deserve to be called out on it.
So I think, you know, a former senior Labour advisor, Andrew Fisher, he was on Sky News yesterday, and he was talking about, let's talk about this policy properly. And that was, this isn't a £28 billion a year. Well, first of all, it turned into £28 billion a year, and then it was by the end of the parliament, and then it turned from a pledge to an ambition, and now it's gone altogether. But the idea was, this is an investment. So as a result, we will see transitions to renewable energy, we'll see jobs created, more likely to see economic growth as a result. How important is it? I mean, the economic times might be difficult, but surely this should be seen as something that will encourage growth, encourage jobs, and encourage the economy, as opposed to, you know, just money that we're spending that we'd never see anything back from.
It's crucial. I'm not suggesting anyone spends this money, you know, because it's a nice to have. This is absolutely necessary. And by the way, the £28 billion in itself wasn't nearly enough. But, you know, that was, for some people, a reason to still vote Labour. But actually, they've abandoned even that last pledge. So just a few months ago, I was at Port Talbot in Wales, and we've seen since then thousands of people lose their jobs. This is a moment where we should be talking about a just transition. And all I mean by that is making sure there's jobs in green jobs for renewables, for making sure that we're essentially protecting our society and giving these people these good jobs. But you can't do that without investment in that technology. So this feels like Labour Party are not only abandoning the workers in terms of they're not supporting the trade unions like they should have traditionally done, but they're also abandoning the workers in terms of their future and the future of how we're all going to survive. So there is no measure that the Labour Party have played this well. They've handled this badly from beginning to end, and it just seems to be getting worse.
It seems, the rumours seem to be that the reason that this has been done is that Labour want to make themselves sort of election-proof, where the Tories can't have anything to beat them over the head with coming into an election. Do you have any sympathy for that, that they're just focused on power and the only way to get power is to make sure that the Tories don't have a stick to beat us with?
I've got no sympathy at all. If you are in politics just to gain power, then actually when you've got power, what are you going to do with it? And if we're seeing the Labour leader, Keir Starmer, bow down to right-wing pressure and Tory pressure right now before he's even in power, what's it going to be like when the heat really gets turned up? And I think more than anything, I think this is demonstrative of, you know, we had Ed Miliband, there was a tweet doing the rounds today where he says, we are committed to this £28 billion. Me, Keir and Rachel will never let this go. And here they are, just letting it go. Now, naturally, at this point, I'd say if people want a party that will stand for environmental justice, that recognises there's no environmental justice without racial, social and economic justice too, that's the Green Party. Labour are just making our job easier.
So just as we have spoken, we've got a breaking news that that's Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer has confirmed that this pledge will be dropped. He has said in a statement that due to the Conservatives crashing the economy and the Chancellor's decision to max out the country's credit card, it would not be possible to reach its previous commitment. So they're essentially saying what we anticipated, and that it's a, you know, the reason for this pledge being binned is because of Conservative mismanagement of the economy. You've got no sympathy for that. I want to ask more broadly on green pledges and the climate crisis. We're headed into an election in 2024. If 99% of global scientists are to be believed, we are also hurtling towards climate catastrophe. We're pretty much already there in terms of the impacts of climate change around the world, from famines to heat waves to mass weather changes around the world. We're likely to see millions, if not billions, of refugees as a result of the climate crisis. Yet we have a political establishment in Westminster that just won't talk about the climate. How, you know, what's your reaction to that as a Green Party? It seems you're the only party that really, you know, Labour had until this pledge, but there seems to be a consensus that we just don't talk about the climate.
Yeah, so I've literally just come from a meeting with the London Fire Commissioner, and he was really clear that in the last couple of years, they've had more phone calls for the London Fire Brigade than in their busiest time since World War II because of wildfires and floods. Those are direct actions of the climate crisis hitting us right here at home. And of course, it's for people who are least resilient and most vulnerable who are going to face the effects worse. So if people's homes are flooded, if you're very wealthy, you can build defences. If you're very wealthy, you'll have insurance. But obviously, most people in this in our society don't have those options. Now, if you look internationally, this is amplified so much more. Places in the global south where people who have done the least to cause the climate crisis are facing these worst effects. And we hear anti-migrant rhetoric from both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party in this country. We should absolutely combat that rhetoric anyway and make humanitarian arguments for immigration. But if they really don't want refugees and migrants, then they need to get on the climate crisis quick, because actually nothing is going to cause more migration and more displacement than the climate crisis, which is ramping up. And we already have, you know, civil wars in places like Syria, which arguably are an after effect of the climate crisis. Often they're about scarcity of resources, about drought, about mass heat. And we're going to see more and more of this as time goes on.
I mean, in Syria, we must also mention there's that little thing of the brutal dictator. Well, Assad, but,
No, absolutely. But the dictatorship is being allowed to flourish in a space where there is not enough resources to go round.
Because I guess Pakistan is another one you could look at, right? A third of Pakistan was underwater at some point in the last couple of years. Large parts of Pakistan have become uninhabitable as a result of the heat as well. Those people are going to go somewhere. And I would agree with you on the discussions around refugees and migrants, but they're certainly going to come here in the future if we don't tackle this crisis.
Yeah, and I'd go a step even further, because I hear what you're saying on Syria, but even if we look at the horrendous things that are going on in Gaza, it is not an obvious climate effect. It is very obviously Netanyahu out of control with a malicious and awful occupation. But actually, fundamentally, it does come back to resources, about people grabbing resources, and fundamentally capitalism on steroids. And so when you hear Keir Starmer talking about growth, 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 and you've got Liz Truss trashing the economy, but now Labour accusing Liz Truss of trashing the economy on the same ideology that they're pushing, I'm not linking what Keir Starmer is doing to brutal dictators, but it is all part of the same system that puts growth over human lives, that puts capitalism over humanitarianism. And ultimately, we need parties who are challenging these narratives, because these are big narratives and we should not accept the status quo.
And so, I mean, we've had lots of criticisms of Labour and the Conservatives. What would the Greens do?
On the climate crisis.
Yeah.
So ultimately, it's about recognizing that this is holistic and ultimately this runs through every option. We need a Green New Deal and we need to make sure that we are putting this investment in. I've already spoken about retrofit.
I think we rank amongst the bottom of certainly the G7, but across Europe in terms of investment in renewables, investment in general, actually, in our public services and others, but investment across renewables, we're nearly rock bottom in the G7 and across Europe.
And interestingly, we were doing really well for about 2012 to 2013. It suddenly looked like we were going to be leaders on things like solar and tidal. But then David Cameron famously said, let's cut the green crap. That meant ultimately it scared everyone from investing because why would you? And then we really got lagged behind. We know from lots of research that's left thousands of pounds on people's bills. So,
and forgive me, by no means am I a climate expert or a scientist in this, but, you know, just common sense, it's not much of it in politics these days, but common sense, we're an island. We should have massive advantages when it comes to green investment, right? From tidal to wind, for example. There should be some natural advantages that comes with being an island in the United Kingdom to be able to invest in renewable energy.
Without a doubt. And also, we could be proud of being those global leaders or at least showing leadership on that. And by the way, these things aren't about sacrifices necessarily or giving up things. This is about cleaner air, more cohesive community, tackling the gender pay gap, the disability pay gap, the ethnicity pay gap. All of these things can and should be done and people can vote for them. And ultimately, the Green Party vision is looking at a society where we radically transform our economy. It's about fundamentally, as soon as you accept this inequality crisis and the fact it doesn't have to be this way, then that's how you change
things. So you've spoken to me about the Green Party's plan for a Green New Deal and others. We're in a general election year, so I would be amiss if I didn't ask you, what's a best case scenario for the Greens in the 2024 general election?
So we're looking to win at least 4 MPs in places like Bristol Central, where we've got Carla Denyer, Brighton Pavilion, where we're looking to hold with Sean Berry, North Herefordshire, where we've got Ellie Chowns facing a Conservative there, and Adrian Ramsey in Waveney Valley.
So in Brighton, you're losing Caroline Lucas. How big of a loss is that for you?
Obviously, she's amazing and she's been incredible in politics. And at the same time, I think the party in the country is at a crossroads where 1 million people in the past have voted Green and we've got one MP.
Let's just talk about that, because honestly, I don't think people appreciate how ludicrous our electoral system here in the UK
and
is.
And 30,000 for a Tory, I think, or something like that.
So per vote, so the Conservative Party, double check these figures if you're listening at home. I am saying it explicitly on air that these numbers aren't exactly right, so don't at me later. But per MP, it's something like 30,000 to 40,000 votes for a Conservative MP and a million votes for one Green MP being returned.
Absolutely. And I think actually one of the shortest returns on investment, so to speak, is the SNP. But credit to the SNP, who massively benefit from the unfair voting system, but still say this is ludicrous and we should have a fair voting system. But ultimately, the bigger point is this as well. The media, whenever there's a green story, anything to do with environmentalism, goes straight to Caroline Lucas. And that fundamentally is not sustainable. We need to be growing a team, different people, more marginalized voices, and making sure that we get these people elected and representative. So Caroline Lucas has done incredible work, but it's a legacy that needs to continue and grow.
And you think you're going to hold on to Brighton?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're not taking a single vote complacently, and we will be out there campaigning. In fact, I'm there just this weekend. I'll be campaigning with Sean.
Oh, nice. So you're hoping for 4 MPs in the general? You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely the minimum at what we're
talking. I don't want to be Piers Morgan here, but will you take out, I don't have £1,000, will you take a £100 bet with me that you'll get 4 MPs?
Well, I do everything in politics to talk about the harms of gambling, so for me to place a bet on there would be pretty,
you know,
pretty horrendous.
Before we had you on, we discussed with the producers as to whether I should do the bet joke. And I said I would, because I had every faith that you would answer it in the way I expect a politician of any moral standing.
We should also talk about cryptocurrency, which also is very problematic.
Rishi, if you're listening, mate, that's how you answer a betting question. Let's move on to the next story. So 4 MPs, it's very interesting. I'd love to have you on closer to the election and after to see what happens. So on Rishi, he's not only facing calls to apologise for the bet, but facing calls to apologise after joking about Labour's position on trans people when the mum of murdered teenager Brianna Gay, who was a transgender person, was in Parliament. During Prime Minister's question, Mr. Sunak ridiculed Sir Keir Starmer for U-turning on, quote-unquote, defining a woman. Number 10 said it was legitimate to question the Labour leader's position, but Brianna's father, who is among the people who's called for an apology, said the PM's comments were degrading. So this is pretty shocking. You know, our politics I didn't think could get any lower, but Prime Minister making a joke in the House of Commons in front of the murdered mother of a transgender person, and joking about defining a woman. How horrific is that to see?
I mean, there's almost no words. Trans people are among the smallest demographic in our society, yet are facing relentless media outrage against their very right and existence to live. We hear scare stories, and being a gay man, it's not lost on me how much this is parallel to what was going on with Section 28 and the toxic narrative around at that time. To put politics in very lightly, I don't think Keir Starmer gets a pass on this either. You know, there's been plenty of questionable comments from the Labour Party that he has just waved by, not just on this, but Islamophobia, by the way, as well. But for the Prime Minister of the country, which, you know, it doesn't get much more significant in terms of your platform, to joke about this and to think them, of all people, are the butt of a joke is an exact demonstration of how this government punches down and thinks that the most vulnerable people in society are just playthings for them.
So I wondered, you know, there's been a large discussion. I've been interested in it, in that obviously this is particularly disgusting and disgraceful from a Prime Minister, given that the Brianna's mother was in the House of Commons at the time that the joke was made.
I think that's a distraction, though. I think, yes, that's horrendous, but ultimately so this the is joke what, should never be made.
Well, this is what I was going to ask, because this jibe about defining a woman has been made back and forth at the dispatch box.
Yeah, and as if no one ever watches TV or listens
to it. Well, it's all broadcast live, right? So, you know, people are outraged now, but surely they should have been outraged when it was said again and again over the past 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, people shouldn't even be making those jokes in private necessarily. I think ultimately if that is your idea of a joke, or that's where your humour lies, then there is something seriously wrong in your life.
How worried are you as a politician, you said as an openly gay man, about what could potentially be a pretty nasty culture war style general election? I mean, as a Muslim, I'm terrified about what's to come, right? And the kind of narrative that's going to be put on display by the Conservatives, potentially reacted to by the Labour Party. Are you concerned about the heat that could come with the general election?
I'm highly concerned, and not just as a gay man, as a Jewish man as well. I think, you know, anyone who comes from any minority group can hear the kind of toxic rhetoric and narrative that has often been stoked by the Conservative Party. The really interesting thing about a culture war is fundamentally, it's not victimless. There are people who are suffering. It's just often they're not in the room. What was really interesting about Prime Minister's questions is, because the mother was in the room, Rishi Sunak is now being pushed to apologise to her. But of course he can't apologise to her if his narrative is to be believed, because he's done nothing wrong, because he says these things all the time.
Yeah.
So we see these narratives and they're just spiraling. And I think,
and it's, I really like the point about it's not victimless, because whenever politicians make these comments, like we've spoken about being a Muslim, being a gay Jewish man, anti-Semitism, anti-LGBT hate crime, Islamophobic hate crime, all shoot up when politicians make these comments. So they have a responsibility.
Yeah, definitely.
And not just when the people are in the room.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hold myself to a higher responsibility with that. And I think all politicians should. That if you have the platform and you have the literal microphone to speak, then of course you should be measured in your comments. Now, that does not mean being wet. It doesn't mean not making a strong argument or a robust argument. But it does mean, when it comes to respecting basic human rights, that's the lowest possible bar. Mm-hmm. And both Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer at times have failed to put it.
And I think we've seen it all around the country and in the world, actually, when politicians run out of things they can say that they can do, run out of ideas and a vision. And when they get desperate, often they attack the most vulnerable people in society for their own political gain. I think that's what we're seeing here on this. You know, we're going to continue on the story or this theme and look to a new poll that was released by the Labour Muslim Network this week that showed that Labour has much work to do in retaining support amongst Muslim voters. A senior party figure has said that the poll suggested the party had lost a portion of its vote amongst its Muslim base. Particularly over its handling of the Israel-Gaza war. 43% of British Muslims who backed Labour at the 2019 general election are willing to do so again, with 23% saying that they are undecided. What's quite key to that is the Green Party has attracted significant support, a bump of 9% amongst Muslims. What's your response, A, to the poll showing a serious crisis amongst the Muslim voter base? With the Labour Party, 86% of Muslims voted Labour in 2019. That's down to 43%, with 23% being undecided. Some people like to take that out. I think that's ludicrous to take out undecided, but so I'm not going to. But a significant response to that first, and then we'll talk about the Greens. What's your response to Muslim voter reactions?
Yeah, I think a few things. I think, obviously, I'm always positive when people want to join or get involved with the Green Party. However, you know, so I'm absolutely not disingenuous. It's under horrific circumstances, and I'd much rather people wanted to join the Green Party because there was a good, positive discussion and debate, and people felt that that's where my home is. I think in the Green Party, we've got a huge amount of work to do. I think one of the misconceptions of the party is it's very white and it's middle class. And I often hear people say there's no diversity in the party.
Yeah.
Now I know...
Can I tell you something? Before sure. I joined the Labour Party, I was at university. I remember being sat on my couch with my flatmates. So we're talking about politics. I was a politics student, but I kind of, you know, I was in my young radical days of fuck all the parties, this sort of stuff, right? And my friend told me to join the Green Party. He was like, it's outside Main. And I was like, they're so white, bro. Like, there's never going to take me. And that was my perception at the time. I obviously joined the Labour Party. I'm glad I did and engaged and became a councillor and parliamentary candidate, still a party member and proud to do so. But that was my perception at the time as a sort of brown Muslim that the Green Party wasn't for me. Probably shifted a little bit. I think Majid, the Lord Mayor, had a huge influence in that. But what you're saying is right.
Yeah, and so well, I think we always need to be careful with this because I sometimes say there's no diversity in the Green Party, and I can think of plenty of black councillors, Muslim councillors who are doing amazing work.
I'm sure there is,
And I think when we say there's no diversity, what we're doing is discrediting their work. However, it's also true in the exact same breath, we have a lot more to do. And ultimately, I think as deputy leader, I see that as my number one job. So in fact, this weekend, I'm going to be in Manchester. We're going to be launching a new Muslim Greens group. This is ultimately, we're going to be having a meeting about what's going on in Palestine. But it can't just be meetings. It can't just be people stepping forward and being candidates, although that's part of it. It has to be a deep embedded commitment to marginalized groups and to the causes that they
care
about.
I have a couple of quick fire questions. We're running over, but I've really enjoyed having you on. A lot of Muslims listen to this show will be curious about what the Green Party has to say. On Israel-Palestine, which seems to be one of the main important things, 85% of Muslims have said it's important and how they're going to vote. The Green Party, does it back a ceasefire, an immediate ceasefire in Gaza?
We were the first party to call for a ceasefire. I've called for it ever since. We also want to ban arms trades to Israel. And I've spoken, as have the leadership, on many Palestinian solidarity marches.
And recognition of Palestine unilaterally, regardless of a peace negotiation?
Yes, absolutely. Within the same breath as well, we do need to release the hostages. And, you know, a ceasefire does mean on both sides. But I think it's clear that Netanyahu had disproportionate power.
Yeah, and I think everybody hopefully agrees that the release of the hostages have to be involved in that as well. Lastly, nothing to do with this, but we've come to the end of the segment, and like I said, I've really enjoyed having you on. Are you going to stand to be an MP?
I'm not. Basically, we have our four target constituencies, and I have to run around all the other constituencies supporting those candidates. So I think I'm much better placed supporting other Greens to become MPs.
But maybe one day?
Oh, for sure.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you. Thank you so much. That's Zach Polansky, Deputy Leader of the Green Party, joining me to talk about the Week Unwrapped and some of the key issues from the $28 billion the pledge that's been abandoned by the Labour Party to Rishi Sunak and Sir Keir Starmer, Muslims and others. We're going to stay on the story of Muslims and this new poll by the Labour Muslim Network showing a collapse in the Labour vote. And we're going to be joined next by Sundar Khetawala, Director of British Future. He's going to join us to continue to talk about this story after this.
FUBAR Radio presents The
Dating Show. So we have got the incredible Sunita.
How does Sunita whittle down the people she wants to talk to the people she doesn't? What's your criteria?
Well, you've got to be an adult.
Okay.
That's always a good start.
Always a good start. But when I'm an adult, not just like 18, you've got to be like not young enough to be my child. You have to ideally be London-based, because I am. Yeah. Although I don't mind if you've got a country pad, that would be nice.
So at the minute we're going with age and location are important.
Age and location are good.
Every Friday from 6 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. This is Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio at Politics Uncensored. We've just had Zach Polansky, Deputy Leader of the Green Party, joining us talk about the Week Unwrapped and some of the key stories. And we ended on a new poll from the Labour Muslim Network, which has found that only 43% of British Muslims who backed the Labour Party at the 2019 general election are definitely willing to do so again, with 23% of them being undecided ahead of the next general election. So Keir Starmer's own favourability has dropped by 4% since 2021 and now sits at minus 11%. It comes at a time of heightened tension over the party's response to the war in Gaza, with 38% of British Muslims saying their view had become more unfavourable to the Labour Party over the past 12 months. Sir Keir Starmer has faced huge pressure from the party grassroots left and the pro-Palestinian campaigners over his initial refusal to back an immediate ceasefire. Joining me now is Sundar Khetawala, Director of British Future. Sundar, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you can hear me okay. What's your initial reaction to this poll?
I think it's good to see Servation and the Labour Muslim Network producing some research on this topic. It's a much debated issue, I think, and it's a representative poll, and that's good to have because there've been other surveys that aren't representative. I think it confirms what a lot of people have been saying, which is that Labour's got challenges with Muslim voters in particular. I think Labour's more popular with the electorate generally than it was in 2019. Here we've got one of the largest minority communities in Britain, and Labour appears to be going backwards, not forwards, losing quite a significant proportion of voters, others uncertain. So there's certainly a challenge there for the Labour Party.
How big of a challenge do you think it is? Because I've seen in a quite an extraordinary Times article this week with one commentator saying that, you know, Labour should just ignore Muslims and lean heavy into its current messaging, and that it can afford to lose the 3 million or so votes that come with Muslims as long as it's strong on security and other things and the kind of current policy it's going down. Do you think Labour could afford to lose the vote in its entirety?
I think that, you know, no minority group, even a large minority, has got a veto over who's in Downing Street. You know, elections are won with votes across community. The Muslim vote has been a strong part of the Labour electoral coalition, as have other Black and Asian and ethnic minority votes. That's going to get more challenging. In the 2024 general election, Labour has the advantage, unless other things go wrong, that they're up with the electorate generally, maybe 8, 10, 12 points generally. So in that sense, even a very significant loss of British Muslim voters of a scale we saw, say, in 2005 after the Iraq War, probably wouldn't make that much electoral difference. But I think it would be a mistake to see this only through an electoral lens. We're talking about a very young community, a very politically engaged community. We're talking about people engaging with politics in the first time. This next general election isn't the only general election the Labour Party will want votes in. They might be needing more younger votes in the inner cities, you know, if they're trying to get re-elected.
I also think
we should see this about community relations.
We're going to touch community relations in a second. But I want to stick to the electoral question first before we go to some of the communal and moral arguments, which we will touch on, I promise. From an electoral perspective, I mean, look, if the 23% undecided, who I think are quite key here, don't return to Labour and vote elsewhere, whether that's independents popping up in different constituencies, or they go to Zach, who was just here with me, the Green Party, or indeed to any other party, then, you know, it might be true to say that given Labour's strong position nationwide, that they may still be able to walk into government. But Muslims are amongst, you know, 3 million Muslims. They're sometimes quite highly concentrated. So if you're an MP, let's say in East London or in Leicester or in Birmingham or in Bradford or in Batley, are you not massively anxious about this poll? Because while it may not affect Labour nationwide, a dip anywhere near what we have seen might seriously hurt your chances of returning to Parliament.
I think Labour MPs are worried about it. I think Labour councillors have a lot more reason to be worried about it than Labour MPs. But I think there might be quite a significant impact on votes. I would calculate that maybe 1 in 12 Labour voters at the last general election were Muslim. It's a large part of their vote. Even if they lost a third of those voters, I don't think it will cost them half a dozen seats next time, unless they have a much bigger meltdown in the opinion polls, which might happen by the end of the year. And the reason I think is this, that I think there are three seats that are majority Muslim, and there is the possibility for the kind of effect you saw once with George Galloway in Bradford and once with George Galloway in Bethnal Green in those three seats. But in the next 30 seats down, I don't think there's a strong contender this time, the Green Party, the Liberal Democrats, the independent candidates, that is going to win the vote across communities. The Labour MPs should work hard for Muslim voters and for other voters, but I can't quite see how in a place like Rochdale somebody's going to defeat the Labour Party unless they're doing incredibly well with both the third of the electorate that is Muslim and with white British voters and other voters. So I think where it will matter more is in SNP Labour marginals in Glasgow, in one or two Conservative seats such as Peterborough or Wickham or Uxbridge or Harrow, where there'll be a very marginal seat with quite a lot of diversity of different kinds. If Labour's down a quarter of its Muslim vote, it could lose them a marginal
seat. This poll is suggesting much higher than a quarter of its vote. It's suggesting it could be anywhere between, depending on if undecideds aren't removed, which I see no reason why they should be, then it could be down significantly, as much as half of the vote.
Yeah, I also think people exaggerate the overall number of voters, and I hope the media will start to get this right. I think there are 2.2 million Muslims eligible to vote in the general election. We know there are 3.9 million people, but obviously a lot of those people aren't 18 yet. So with a average turnout among Muslims and other groups and the vote staying up, I think we're talking about 1.5 million votes being cast. And Labour, if they weren't losing any voters at all, would be hoping to get a million Muslim votes. And I think they could be losing 300,000, 400,000 votes on this kind of poll. It's a lot of votes, and I think that could be a massive mm-hmm. issue for them.
So one of the key constituencies, for example,
tight general election.
So one of the key, I think you're right in terms of marginal constituencies. One of the key questions, for example, is Ilford North, I think, which is West Streeton seat, where 27% of the constituency are Muslim, and if they have a 5,000 majority, that might be a really, really tight race. If you know Labour were to lose between, you know, a half of its vote, maybe a little bit less. In Uxbridge and South Ruislip, where I stood, I certainly couldn't have afforded to lose half of my Muslim vote, for example. So could it be not just in seats that have, you know, a majority Muslim, but really tight seats, this might become a problem?
I think that's right. I think it will be in seats like Uxbridge much more where it is an issue. I think one thing that, as I say, you know, Labour should worry about the socialisation of young people. It should worry about this election, the next election. It should worry about mm-hmm. local elections. I think one place where I think they're fortunate at the moment is the Conservative vote is splintering in all directions. So while, you know, 30% of people voted Conservative in Rochdale, 30% of people voted Conservative in Batley, a splintering of the Labour vote would let the Conservatives in if the Conservatives were holding mm-hmm. on to their vote.
Okay, let's
I think it's not impossible that things will go worse for Labour on broader fronts, but I think they've got to think about this as a community relations issue.
And I think, look, one of the things we should also bear in mind, this is a poll right now, and the war is continuing in Gaza, and Labour's response continues, and things could move in any direction. They could continue further down, or they could improve if Labour's policy position, as far as Muslims' perceptions are, could improve. I want to now move on to, I think what you're right, and I'm glad you've raised it, because politics isn't all about electoral questions. It's about the morality and the community element as well. The reason 86% of Muslims voted Labour or have supported Labour is, for the longest time, not to homogenise an entire community, Muslims have largely felt comfortable and safe in Labour hands. That certainly seems not to be the case anymore. How much of a communal problem is that for an entire community that might now find themselves politically homeless?
Well, I think it is a challenge. I don't believe the 86% number, which the technical reasons why ask people how they voted in 2021, in 2019, don't work. More than 1% of people voted Liberal Democrat in 2019. But Labour's tended to have probably 75-80% of the Muslim vote under Jeremy Corbyn. It had 65% in 2010. I think what's interesting about the Labour Muslim Network surveys is they show that this didn't start with the October the 7th and the Palestine issue.
Correct,
because there
yeah.
is a 2021 survey which shows that
there was a dip in 2021 as well,
now,
yeah.
To some extent, I think it's good that Labour should have to work harder for ethnic minority votes and for Muslim votes in this century than they did in the last century. I think the British Muslim community is one of the most politically active, politically engaged ethnic and faith minority communities you'll find anywhere in Europe. I think it wasn't very present in the political system at the time of the Iraq War. People forget there was one Muslim MP in England in 2003 when the Iraq War broke out. So I think one of the reasons this is more challenging is we've got a much bigger presence in parliament, in local government. I think a lot of younger Muslims are now saying, but what's the point of having 50, 20 MPs if parties don't do what we want? Should we support independent candidates? I think that's part of the democratic system. You know, you want, I think, all parties to want your vote and for not to have some parties thinking you're out of reach and so on. So I think Labour will be made to sweat, and you know, there'll be independents, there'll be Greens, there'll be Liberal Democrats. The Conservatives used to be trying to get Muslim voters under David Cameron. I think they've gone backwards as mm-hmm. well. So I think there's a
generation. Do you think that's at all possible? Do you think Conservatives have an opportunity? I mean, their policy has been much worse on Gaza or about as bad. Do you think there's an opportunity that they could step in or no?
I think the Conservatives have actually been picking up more Bangladeshi, British Bangladeshi votes for a while now than British Pakistani votes. But where David Cameron and Saeed Arasi, I think, were very much saying we want to appeal to all minority groups and we want to work well, I think the Conservatives have created a lot of new baggage with Muslim voters in the last 5 or 10 years, things like the Zach Goldsmith campaign in London. So they're very much flatlining on a tenth of the vote.
Yeah. And of course, they refuse to say the word Islamophobia.
I hope we don't get into a position where the Conservatives think there are some minorities who will vote for us and some minorities who won't. I'd like to see the Conservatives trying much harder with British Muslim voters and Black British voters. I just think that the low political ebb they're in, and, you know, I think they haven't been attentive to anti-Muslim prejudice in their own party. I mean, Nuz Ghani, the Conservative Muslim MP, you know, was very clear that she'd faced, you know, discriminatory language right at the top of the party. So I hope the party will get back to what it was trying to do under David Cameron in the domestic policy. Mm-hmm. On foreign policy, you know, I think both parties might be balancing their position a bit more. Britain has a pretty weak voice in terms of its level of influence over the Israeli government compared to maybe the United States government, which is also...
But I mean, look, one of the things Muslims will be saying right now is, for example, Labour reversed its position on the recognition of Palestine unilaterally, which was in the party manifesto previously. So Keir Starmer came out and said that it would only be recognised as part of peace negotiations. And it seems like the Conservative Foreign Secretary, Lord Cameron, went even further than Labour would by saying that they could potentially unilaterally recognise Palestine as a way to get peace negotiations moving. So it seems like, you know, in certain areas, Labour has even been outflanked by the Conservatives on this issue.
From a national and international perspective, I think it would be good if both of the British parties were very clear about the two-state solution being something that has to be a necessary practical plan beyond the war. I think what is difficult about the calls for a ceasefire, which people are perfectly entitled to make, is that the voice of Keir Starmer or Sadiq Khan or David Cameron or Rishi Sunak, they could all say different things. Their level of influence over the conflict itself with the Netanyahu government, I think, is very, very limited.
But the question is one of values and morals. And I think that's one thing that Muslims are saying is it's first of all, you know, there's a question about level of influence and what can be done. I mean, certainly what you could not do is what you could do is help the support in providing aid. But what Muslims will want to see is that the thousands of lives, 10,000 children, over 10,000 children now who have been killed, they'll want to see that their politicians want to see an end to that. From a values perspective,
I think it's really important to work for an end to the conflict and for.
So it's not meaningless to call for a ceasefire, is what I'm saying.
No, it's not. It's not meaningless. I just think that the level of influence of British politicians on the Middle East is not zero, but it's very low on this particular Israeli.
And so, Sander, I just want to ask you one last question before we go. I'd be interested in your perspective on. Look, there's no doubt. I don't think anybody in the Labour Party now doubts that there is a problem with its relationship with the Muslim community. We might be able to debate how big the problem is, though I don't know why anyone would at this point, but we might be able to debate that. But there's no question that there is a problem. If you were to advise the Labour Party to improve its relationship with the Muslim community, what would you say?
I think it just has to get out there and engage, even if it's very, very difficult. I think the worst thing for the Labour Party to think, and maybe some people are thinking it, is, well, it's very tough right now. We better wait till things calm down. I think they've got to take on the heat of the issue and show that they're there to engage people in the Labour Party who've, you know, called for a ceasefire and haven't persuaded other people, have to explain why they're still in the party.
You know, one of the rumours, Sunder, one of the rumours I've heard, and I don't want to give it too much airtime, but I've heard enough of this rumour to be concerned about it, is that there's a concern in Westminster that appearing too close to Muslims provides others to think that you are soft on security or you have a security problem vis-a-vis terrorism. Do you think that's a potential problem in Westminster?
No, I think, you know, there are voices, you know, on the right of the right wing party. Maybe there are some, you know, voices, you know, in the Labour Party as well who take that view. I think the Labour Party, you know, in this polling is polling low with Muslims that it has, but as high with Muslims as it is with other parts of the community. If it's getting 45%, 50%, 60%, it needs to value every vote and every voter. What I think is going on here is a massive generational shift where some older voters are still loyal to Labour by habit, even when they're unhappy with the policy, but they haven't got a relationship at all, I think, with the 18 to 24 year olds. And what I would advise Labour to do is to start to build relationships with people who haven't inherited this sense that the Labour Party is their party and is always on their side. That was a very strong view of the first and second generation. I think younger people don't have that. And so I think Labour at all levels just has to do the work of politics and engage when it's difficult and have the courage to do that.
Okay, thank you. That was Sundar Katwala, Director of British Future, joining me digitally to talk about this poll. We're going to continue talking about it and some of its findings. Now, let's remind you of some of those numbers. And that's the poll done by Salvation has found that 43% of British Muslims who backed Labour in 2019 will definitely do so again, with 23% of them being undecided. That's down from 86% according to a 2021 poll. Sir Keir's own favourability, the leader of the Labour Party, sits at -11%, lags far behind the party overall, which was at +24%. The party itself is down by more than 20%. Party identification is down by 20%. 38% of British Muslims say the party has become more unfavourable to them over the last 12 months, and a staggering 85% have said that the Israel-Palestine conflict will make a significant impact and is important to how they will decide to vote. This is after a Gaza invasion, which has now seen over 25,000 people killed, 10,000 of whom are children. Joining me next is Murad Qureshi, former Labour member of the London Assembly, who was actually a member and comes from my part of the world in Kilburn. He'll be joining me after this.
Hey! FUBAR Radio presents
Access All Areas.
Mark from Married at First Sight UK.
See, at the wedding, you told Sean you were 26, but you're actually 36.
Oh, yeah.
So drop in that decade. We ain't gone 1 or 2 years either side. What was going through your head when you thought, I'm going to shave off 10 years.
A 26. Third of your life.
Yeah.
It was instant reaction. As soon as anyone says to me, how old are you? I'm like 26. I just stopped counting after 26. Would I have told him? Probably not.
No. Ever?
Well, maybe when we're 80 years old and we've got the grandkids running round.
Except you wouldn't be 80 years old. You'd be 90.
Yeah, you'd be 90. I'd be 26 still. I'd be going around the corner for some more injections.
Politics Uncensored. Joining me now, the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, MP. And there you are, stood with hundreds of thousands of people at Glastonbury singing, "Oh, Jeremy Corbyn." What is that like?
It was quite extraordinary. It was an amazing experience, and I was very pleased we did it. The office got very excited about Glastonbury. Every single person in the office thought it was necessary for them to be at Glastonbury.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. Yeah.
Every single one said it was really necessary for them to come. The
Dating Show. I'm friends with a fair few exes, and I think you can be friends with an ex, but I genuinely do. But I do think that it's timing is everything with that.
I think it depends what you cast as a friend.
Yeah,
are you someone you're going to hang out with on your sofa? Like, if you've already shagged, you know, isn't that a bit weird?
Think that's a different level of friend. I think that's a different level of... You can be friends with someone, you can't be, like, best fucking friends with someone. I mean, I've got exes that I talk to about their current partners and whatever else, and they'll tell me about that sort of stuff, but I wouldn't say, oh, do you want to come over for fucking Chinese and chill on the sofa?
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. This is Ali Milani of Politics Uncensored, and joining me now is Murad Qureshi, former London Assembly member, Labour Party member, and he is going to be talking to us about the new exclusive poll done by Salvation showing a collapse in support from British Muslim communities to the Labour Party. Murad, thank you so much for joining us. Tell me, first of all, your initial reaction to this poll. It shows a serious decline in Muslim support for the Labour Party. Everything from party identification to how people are going to vote, all of that seems to have taken a hit. Are you surprised?
Well, thank you for inviting me, firstly. Not surprised, because we've been here before. I'm old enough to remember 20 years ago when I first stood for the London Assembly in the midst of the Iraq War, 1 year in, and 1 year in we were getting a sense of where it really was. None of the weapons of mass destruction were found. There was huge amounts of fatalities, collateral damage. And I think the parallels are very similar. I saw it in my neck of the woods very clearly. And I think what we found in that election, the 2004 London GLA election, with Ken Livingstone as our mayoral candidate, he made it quite clear what his position was. And it didn't really affect him because everyone knew where he stood. And I think Sadiq has similarly done a similar thing by saying right from the outset he's for a ceasefire. He was for a ceasefire. But I do think it did affect the assembly, the vote right across town. And you know, it was actually.
I wonder if you can take us back there, because I'll be honest with you, I don't remember the Iraq War. I'm a little bit too young for that.
Yeah.
You don't look like you should remember the Iraq War.
Yeah,
but a lot of parallels have been drawn with what happened then. A huge amount of anger within the community, discontent with labor. You know, I can only talk about what's happening this time. All I know is, you know, broadly amongst Muslim communities, I've seen vitriol, anger, feelings of betrayal. Yeah. Was it like that back then?
Well, yeah, I think it was broadly similar. I remember door knocking in places like Brent and having the door slammed on my face very clearly. Mm-hmm. And I'd never had so many doors slammed in my face since. Mm-hmm. Subsequently, nothing like that at all. And it was particularly a poignant time. It was also clear.
And we're seeing images similar to that in Rochdale right now that are coming out.
Well, I don't know too much about Rochdale, so I'm very, very keen to know what's happening there. And also, there were actually other national leaders saying different things. People forget Charles Kennedy was very clearly anti-Iraq war, and I think it helped the Lib Dems considerably at the time.
Yeah.
I don't think they've got the same figurehead now, but Charles
certainly
Kennedy,
not in terms of charisma.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he spoke well, and he made his points very succinctly. And
but they do have a very, it's very similarly, again, they do have a very different position. The Lib Dems have called for a ceasefire.
True. Well, it'd be interesting to see if they can pitch that further. And also, one of the things, the better things that they have in the Gaza context is Leila Moran, you know, Palestinian British woman. And I think she's got relatives in Gaza. She also.
And I don't think that has been without impact, because we're looking at the poll suggests not just the Labour collapse, but the Greens are up 9% and the Lib Dems are up 5%. SNP is also up as well.
Well,
so.
Look, that doesn't surprise me, because I think one of the things is look, it does affect the Muslim communities in all the varieties of Muslims we've got, and you know, and I do, we're not a homogeneous mass.
Yeah.
Ethnically nor religiously, but if there's one core issue that, you know, we all agree on is Palestine.
But so before we get to that, I want to keep us back in 2004. Door slammed in your face, lots of anger. There was still a relative amount of success. I mean, Labour did win the general election, but also you were successful as well. Was the key, as was Ken, was the key in differentiating the individual Labour politicians with the party's position nationally?
Well, that's interesting. Looking back at it, I don't think the Labour Party as such had a distinguishing message, because we were, you know, we found ourselves on the national picture. Whilst Ken was distinct, he had actually been an independent mayor up until that point and took on the Labour nomination. So people were kind of used to it. I think where it did affect us was...
Yeah, but how did you overcome knocking on doors?
I'll tell you,
that's
interesting. I actually, in that election... people like myself and Ken were allowed to say what we thought.
Oh, they let you do that?
Oh, yeah.
That's not happening now. I'll tell you that much for free.
No, exactly. Well, you know, I didn't take it for granted. I was aware of that, and I never had anyone coming down on me.
But there was an understanding in the party that you could hold a different position. Yeah. What's interesting is I had Michael Crick sat in this chair not too long ago, and he said the same thing about Blair's era, for example. He said, listen, there was an understanding that we can disagree in the party. Yeah. It's okay.
No. Well, that certainly was there, and I was doing the rounds similar to now, and I no one tapped me on the back and said, "Oi, Murad, what the hell are you talking about, and what are you saying that for?" Mm-hmm. It was quite clear that actually there was scope to do that from, and Ken made the room in some ways, because he was saying that anyway.
Right.
So if they did haul me in, I could say, "Well, Ken's saying it. Why can't I?" So it never quite happened there. But you're right. There was a climate where different
and
views
of course,
were tolerated.
There is a little bit of protection similar to Ken, because Sadiq has said it, Anas has said it, and other things.
Yeah,
on ceasefire and Palestinian recognition and stuff like that, some of the major politicians in the Labour Party have said it. Yeah. It's just the leadership that hasn't been reflected, and that anger comes from the community.
And thankfully, other things have happened. I mean, let the world be grateful for what the South Africans have done.
ICJ.
It's gut-wrenching seeing those images day in, day out. Many of those
You think that's had an effect, that people are seeing the images live every day coming out of Gaza?
I certainly know. I've been door knocking during all this as well, in places in Maida Vale and Kilburn.
Represent South Kilburn.
But it was interesting. You know, we dropped a door. We've put a leaflet out in Little Venice. Posh bit of Little Venice. Immediately that afternoon, we had an email saying that a couple, clearly young professional couple, Randolph Crescent, Very, very expensive yeah. bit of Little Venice.
Yeah, when I said represent for the audience, Little Venice was not what I was talking about.
But anyway, they said very clearly in an email to us that they're never going to vote for Labour.
Because, on this issue.
On this issue. So look, I think, people may emphasise the Muslim aspect to it, but don't think this is only affecting Muslims.
It's not just Muslims. So tell me about let's fast forward now. Tell me about some of the stories on this. You've been door knocking. Have you felt it come back?
Yeah, no, that's an example.
Yeah.
You know, and whilst we didn't have face-to-face contact, we were doing put a flyer through.
But what about any Muslims? I'll give you an example. Yeah. I'll tell a story. First time on air, I've told this story. I went to a press screening of a film. I won't talk about what film because it'll give away lots of things. But and everybody knows I'm a Labour Party member. I was a candidate councillor and I'm a Muslim.
Yeah.
And I had two different, quite senior Muslims come up to me and go, what the hell are you playing at? Why are you still in the party? Why do you persist? Are you guys as Islamophobic? All that kind of stuff. You know, I've getting called sellouts and that sort of thing. Yeah. That's the sort of stuff we have to contend with. Are you getting that sort of thing?
I had that in my local gym in Porchester. I said, someone tapped me on the back. I expected to resign. You know, I said, I'm completely off guard.
Yeah.
And I'm pulling my weights and what have you.
Yeah.
And on the edge of road. I mean, it's no doubt a lot of people.
But there's the impact it has on Muslims.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and we've got all varieties there, from Sunni, Shias, Moroccans.
Oh, no, this cuts right through.
It cuts right through. So that's the street, you know, the road
I go. And has your response been similar to what it was in 2004 and differentiating your position?
Well, personally, yes. I don't see any problems with that, personally. Mm-hmm. And someone's got pulled me into, and no one's pulled me in and said, Oi, Murad, this time.
Yeah.
And said, you're
out. Oh, they haven't done that to you yet? I've had that.
And, you know, locally in the party as well. I think very often these kind of issues, avoiding them is not the best way of dealing with them. I think it has to be dealt with internally in the party as much as externally. And I think we have to have clear, frank discussions. The public are for the first time seeing, it's not mass slaughter of civilians, babies, for God's sake. I mean,
Images of dead babies people under rubble. Yeah.
I mean, there was a bit of public art, I think they did in Bournemouth beaches. They spread out.
Yeah, led by donkeys.
They've spread out the number of, there were babies killed on October the 7th.
Yeah, for those listening, go and check it out. They did was they set out, I think, baby clothes across the beach, and it went for miles because over 10,000 kids have been killed.
That really hit home when I saw that. I sent it around and on my social media. But I think that, you know, that's the message we've been having.
Yeah,
and we're not used to that.
We've been talking about some of the electoral impacts. We had it with Sunday. Yeah. And we spoke a little bit about it with Zach. It's London mayoral election year, and Sadiq is standing to be re-elected. Now, he has set his position as being significantly differently, but you've got lots of experience in this area.
Yeah.
Muslims highly concentrated in London. Yeah. I think there's about 4 million Muslims across the country. Yeah. They're not all voting age and all that kind of stuff, but a significant number are in London. Yeah. Could it have an impact?
Well, look, I think Sadiq will survive. I think the Tory candidate is so bad. He's got to beat her, even though they've changed the rules, first past the post, etc.
Can you just explain that a little bit? We've gone from first past the post to what?
Well, previously...
Oh, we've gone to first past the post,
Previously, you had first and second preferences.
Yeah.
So you could put your first preference as Sadiq and then someone else.
Yeah. Where or you could put a green as your first preference and Sadiq as second.
Exactly. So that's where it comes in. So, for example, last time when he was up against Sean Bailey, it was actually quite close.
Another
shit
candidate.
Yeah. The Tories don't take this position seriously anymore.
Why don't they? Because they want it with Boris.
Well, I don't understand it, but that's for them to sort out.
I mean, you thought it couldn't get worse with him, and now they've sent Susan Hall, is it? Don't give her a microphone. Actually, give her a microphone, because that'll do all the campaigning for Sadiq.
You're right, and she'd probably help do wonders for the campaign.
Yeah. But Susan, you're welcome to come on the show and contest this.
but the second preferences of the Greens and Lib Dems did come over Sadiq last time, and that was quite clear.
Yeah.
He's made a pitch for them, telling them, you're going to have to vote for me first, your first preference is to me now because of the system.
Who's made that change? The Assembly?
No, it wasn't. It was something the Tories did in national government. I find it extraordinary. I mean, Londoners were just getting used to that idea, and now suddenly they're going back to first past the post.
So you think Sadiq will be fine? Is that largely because, you know, he set out his position differently?
Well, yeah, I think
he himself is Muslim, which kind of helps.
Well, I mean, he's... He's playing, he has to play an interesting game. Where it will have impact, I'm afraid, I think Labour may well lose a few Assembly members. It happened in 2004. It could happen now, because the overall vote will come down.
Yeah, so there's going to be an impact.
Yeah, it's going to be an impact. I mean, for example, if you look at the East End where we have the solid block votes in places like Tower Hamlets, Newham.
No chance. Yeah,
Redbridge, yeah. Barking Town. I can't see it. It's not my end of town, but all the messages I'm getting... From that end of town is quite clear.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I know more about what's happening there than certainly Rochdale.
Right. Yeah.
And that would be their first opportunity.
Yeah. And lastly, the time has flown. Again, really enjoyed having you on because it's really interesting to hear. Mm. I mean, everybody talks to me around the Iraq War and I nod and smile, but genuinely, I was like 4 or 5 years old. No, that's not true. Like 6 or 7. But so lastly, look, I asked under this and I want to ask you. You have a huge amount of expertise and knowledge and experience. Mm. There are Labour people that listen to this show. I know that. It's people in Lotto. What advice would you give them to try and mend this relationship with the Muslim community?
Well, look, I think they've got to look very clearly at what's happening out there. Yeah. I find it very difficult that we're not being more critical of Netanyahu. I mean, he's thrown out the two-state solution completely. It's quite clear.
His ambassador to the UK did that very explicitly.
And I think that's we've got to distinguish between the different types of Israeli governments that could be there. And the present one is not working towards a two-state solution, never has been. Mm-hmm. And he's made that very clear.
I mean, they've also rejected in its entirety the ceasefire deal today. Which is really, really significant. Murad, I'm going to ask you to stay because I'm really interested beyond this topic over the next segment. And this is my favorite segment, and it's one that we have every week or most weeks. And that is Word on the Street. And that's where our wonderful producers head to the streets of central London to find out what people really think. Mm-hmm. And our question this week is Rishi Sunak has placed a £1,000 bet with Piers Morgan that the Rwanda scheme will be up and running by the end of the year. I tried that with Zach, didn't quite work. So the question we asked audiences was, what's one 2024 prediction you'd confidently place a £1,000 bet on?
I think England will win the Euros. Yeah, we'll go against France and we'll beat them this time.
I'm thinking Tories out by the end of 2024. It's been too long. I think people are sick of them. And I think their time's up. I don't know if Labour with Keir or what, but I think we'll have a Labour government by the end of the year.
My prediction is that Tom Holland and Zendaya will get married.
My prediction for 2024 is it's going to be a very, very tough year and I'm so glad I'm not in business anymore.
Prince William will become the king.
My prediction is that Prince William will be in charge of the country by the end of the year. Take from that what you will. Not necessarily, I don't think the king's going to die, but I think Prince William will take over and he'll abdicate.
I think Kanye's going to have a baby. I don't think anyone can predict a name that EA is going to come out with because it's all just crazy. He'll just think of something, maybe Flower, just say some random name.
What an eclectic group of people. First of all, I really thought people had killed off the king and I'm glad I had the abdication because I don't know what they know that I don't know. But we heard a wide variety of stuff. Yeah. I mean, Zendaya and Tom Holland get married. I'm gonna just face right through that. There were predictions that the Tories would be gone. What's your reaction to that, Brett?
Well, I can't see any other conclusion when a general election happens. The thing I'm really fearful of is, I think we're nearer to a world war in the Middle East than we realise.
Oh, you really think so? Yeah.
I'm not a pessimist by nature, but I just think that all the things that are happening there.
From Yemen to Iran to Syria.
And it just needs one small thing going wrong. And, we've had retired generals talking about conscription and things like this.
How would you fare in the army?
Personally,
I'd be fucking awful, by the way.
Personally, I think that's when I'll claim I'm a pensioner.
Yeah.
But,
age do you have to be? I'm a pensioner now.
It's up to 60, but for young men.
No, you know what
issue.
I could do?
It's an issue.
For the generals listening, and when they bring in conscription, I can host the radio show of the army.
Yeah.
God, yeah, Good that, Morning Vietnam gets replaced with Good Morning Tehran. Murad, I've got a minute left with you. What's your one prediction? I'm not going to put a £1,000 bet on it. I don't have £1,000, but what's your one prediction for 2024? It can be political, it can be non-political.
Manchester United is not going to win the Premiership.
All right, let's cut his mic. Thank you very much. That was Murad Qureshi joining us, former London Assembly member, joining us to talk about, amongst other things, the collapse in support from the Muslim community to the Labour Party. But I'm just going to put the mic down there because he started to talk bad about Manchester United. Murad, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed having you on. Thank you to everybody listening. We have had a really good show today. We've spoken about a number of things. We had Zach Polensky on, Deputy Leader of the Green Party, and he spoke to us about the £28 billion pledge, Labour's dropping of that, the Green Party's reaction. I tried to get him to bet with me, as per Piers Morgan. It seems he has more sense than the Prime Minister does. He also spoke about potential outreach from the Green Party to the Muslim community as well. We spoke about this poll around the Muslim community. We had Sundar Katwala, Director of British Futures, and we talked about a little bit about the electoral poll, and Murad Qureshi gave us a little bit of background about what had happened in the past, back in 2004 and 5, which I am far too young to remember. I still like to think of myself as young, but sometimes I look in the mirror and these grey hairs are getting more frequent. But that is the Labour Party. I want to thank all of our guests and listeners for joining us for what has been a brilliant show. You can go back and listen to all of our previous episodes on Apple, on Spotify, and on all good podcasting platforms. You can follow us at FUBAR Radio on Instagram, Twitter, or X, as Elon would like. By the way, Elon has gone off the rails. I've got 10 seconds here, but this guy is Lex Luthor reincarnated. I've called it here first. You can follow me at Ali Milani UK on Twitter, Instagram, and I have a TikTok now, so go and follow it there. Join me next week. Thank you so much. Salams.